Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for February 10th. Welcome, Tim.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, big week in national politics. And, of course, aren't we in Georgia, we had our caucus and some of our other fellow southern states like Alabama, Tennessee, Louisiana had theirs yesterday, and Virginia, another state we cover, having theirs in just a few days, and on Tuesday. So we got a lot of southern action going on the national scene. And then, of course, here in Georgia, had a lot of state news to cover, and we're actually going to have Representative Rob Talay come in later. Also going to get the GOP perspective later from Buzz Brockway, which is a pretty big activist and blogger on the right side of the aisle from Gwinnett County. So a big show as far as that goes. Over in Mississippi, there was a little news to cover about their Senate race. But yeah, Tim, just I guess starting out with the Democrats, because we'll save the Republican side for about 7:10 when Buzz calls in. What were your thoughts?
Well, obviously a very good week for Senator Obama, depending on who you look at. And I'm looking at CNN. This thing is just almost even now in the delegate count. When you count up all the people who have voted, I believe less than 200,000 votes separate Senators Clinton and Obama. This thing now is just as tight as it can be, but obviously the wind is at his back, David.
I agree. I think definitely. I mean, if you looked at just Super Tuesday, I mean, that was pretty much a dead tie. But you just got the sense that there was more momentum. Fundraising was going a little bit better for Barack Obama. You know, there was just more momentum about it. And that carried into yesterday and today over the weekend. I believe he's won 5 places now with Maine coming in for him.
Right.
Right over the weekend. That's 5.
Right.
He's 5-0 this weekend. His fundraising's better. And, of course, even though they say the change of campaign manager – on Hillary Clinton's campaign was not related to just strictly performance of wins and losses. It just comes at a bad time, I think.
I don't know about that, David. I think, obviously, there's no change if Senator Obama didn't have the winning streak he's got going. Plus, you couple that with the fact that earlier this week it was announced that Senator Clinton had to loan her campaign $5 million. You know, who would have thought that a few months ago? This was the $100 million machine that was going to just, you know, waltz to the thing. Everything was set up for him, even the calendar. Super Tuesday was supposed to have precluded what is going on now. It's just amazing to watch.
Yes, and you wonder where the money went because, I mean, like, for instance, Barack Obama was the only candidate in Georgia to even run television ads. They say television ad running is down. And that's, of course, the number one expenditure for political campaigns, typically, is television ads. So,
yeah, there's another thing that her campaign has done, too, with money that has turned out to hurt them really badly in a lot of these caucus states. They haven't invested the money and manpower into these states that Senator Obama has. And he's winning all of them, and he's winning them handily, and he's piling up delegates in these states. There are a lot of small states, but right now every delegate counts, and certainly these delegates count too. I think the Clinton campaign made a huge mistake right there if they had the money to invest and didn't do so.
Yes, I saw some of those smaller western states And, you know, Idaho, what was his win there? It was just a shocking.
It was like 79-17, David. She barely exceeded the 15% threshold to get any delegates at all.
Yes, it was just really, really ugly. Another one, you know, North Dakota, obviously a state where.
There was 61-37.
Yeah.
Go to Utah. Utah. 56. She lost by 18 points in Utah.
Yes, I mean, obviously the Utah races weren't close, and you know, you realize that Mitt Romney, the Mormon thing, maybe a lot of people, you know, in Utah didn't think it was an Islamic name. They thought it was a Mormon name, Barack Obama.
Well, let's pick another state. Let's pick another state. Let's pick Minnesota. You got a 2% minority population in that state, and he won it 67-32. Again, a caucus state that he invested money and manpower in, her campaign did not.
Yes, and you I get the sense the campaign we saw in Georgia, and not so much the campaign that his people and he wanted to put forward, but the people that coalesced around his campaign, and what we see in a southern state with a higher minority population, and what you see in a state like Utah, North Dakota, Idaho, Minnesota, is a different campaign. Do you get that sense?
I really do, David. And another thing that's helping him in these caucus states that he is sweeping, like over this weekend, is helping him in other upcoming states in the polls. I'm looking at the polls right now for Survey USA, which is the latest thing done in Virginia and Maryland. Well, he's 20 points ahead in Virginia, and he's 19 points ahead in Maryland. And, of course, he's going to be a prohibitive favorite in Washington, D.C. Tuesday is going to be another very good day for the Obama campaign.
You'd have to think. And then does the momentum start to really pick up so that it carries other states like Ohio and Texas, which are essential for Senator Clinton to win, and change the dynamics there? And
well, they say that's her new firewall, Ohio, Texas, and then in April, Pennsylvania. But if he's winning all of these states leading up to it, why should the momentum stop in a state like Ohio when, with a nearly 30% African-American population and a population of young voters that would be very friendly to a person like Obama?
If I'm not mistaken, Ohio State University was the largest university in the nation.
Yeah.
You'd have to think that would be a big juggernaut there in Columbus.
Absolutely.
And so that's another thing, and it's just so much momentum. Also, another thing that has to be momentum in his side is these two polls now, Time and CNN, even though they're, I believe, both owned by Time Warner AOL, they both show Senator Obama running better than John McCain, and Hillary Clinton runs better than John McCain in one poll and tied with him in another. So then if electability comes into play, which it hasn't been discussed near as much in 2004, where John Kerry, if he won on one thing, it was electability.
Right.
When does that start coming in?
But if there was anyone who was talking about electability, it was the Clinton campaign. You know, I've been the one who's fought the battles before. I know how to handle the Republican attack machine, this and that and the other. Well, then the polls are going to have to start agreeing with her. She can't make that argument anymore.
Yes,
been a good week for Senator Obama.
Yes, I think one thing almost anybody could say, though, is there's probably no new attack line they can really come up with Senator Clinton. I mean, they've just kept on and kept on and kept on, so they'll just be beating the same old drums, you know, telling the same old lies. And honestly, I have heard that her and John McCain are quite good friends, so at least out of the official campaign, it may not be as nasty, although Republicans seem to have their own little shadow committees like the Swift voters that probably would not hold themselves up to such high standards.
Yeah, the surrogates will be glad to take care of the dirty work when the time comes. Don't worry about that.
Yes. But then I get to thinking, you know, Georgia was such a different story with him winning 60 out of 31 delegates, whereas Alabama was a 27-27 delegate split, And Tennessee, she actually won the delegates up there. The number's 42-31. What made Georgia so much better for Senator Clinton?
You know, you mean so much worse for
so much
Senator
worse.
Clinton.
I'm sorry, I got a mix.
You know, I have been trying to figure that out. In Georgia, she gets 31% of the vote, and he gets 67%, and right north of here, in a state that should vote kind of similarly, we're looking at her winning that state, Tennessee, by 13 points. And we're looking at her running some better, even in, a lot better in Alabama than she ran here. I'm not sure what happened.
And as far as demographics, minority population, Alabama is much more similar than Tennessee would be. Well, I see Buzz just came on in, and we'll switch to the Republican side of the aisle. Welcome, Buzz.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, glad to have you. I know that bloggers had speculated this would be a hostile environment. I think that's the first time this has ever been called a hostile environment. We pride ourselves on being kind to our guests. We've had Republican pollsters from Strategic Vision, Republican, congressional candidates at the time, and everybody always thinks we're gracious. We may be partisan on our side, but we're always nice to our Republican guests.
Well, great. Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yes. Well, I guess if we would have had you on the show around Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we would just talk about, hey, it's all set. How does everybody coalesce around McCain? But then last night, Mike Huckabee, or people, Republican voters, however you want to say it, came together and maybe said not so fast, but showed a sense of buyer's remorse. Or what do you make of what happened where Huckabee won at least two contests, and then in the one McCain looks to have won Washington, he won with a whopping 26% of the vote. What do you make there?
Well, I think it shows that McCain, even though he had a speech at CPAC this past week, the Conservative Political Action Caucus, which was well received, he still has a lot of work to do to bring those who don't like him over to his side. I just don't see any scenario whereby McCain doesn't win the nomination. The math is just not there for Huckabee or anybody else. But it does point to McCain still got a lot of work to do to bring the party together.
Yes, I mean, and I saw John King last night did a really good job of showing how, because they're not all winner-take-all states, and he gave a 60-40 split to Huckabee, and he gave every state to Huckabee, McCain still, by the last or next-to-last state, ekes over the threshold. But you got to think, if that's how he wins it, is eking over the threshold, is there a scenario where people try to force him aside for a new candidate, maybe not Huckabee, maybe not Romney, but somebody new because he comes into the convention or comes into the end of the time with so little juice?
Well, I don't think there's a lot of the people who are criticizing or have criticized McCain, most notably in talk radio like Rush Limbaugh, for example, don't look at Huckabee as a much better alternative. So I can't see this great groundswell for Huckabee, and with Romney out of the race, and with even now Ron Paul backing down, I can't see that happening where McCain is pushed aside. I think it would, I think you want to see pretty quickly for those Republicans who want to win in November, which hopefully is all of us. We need to see some healing and some coalescing behind McCain and saying, yes, we've got problems with him, but let's move forward here.
Yes. Now you mentioned Ron Paul, and we've actually postulated, and I know we're not the only people that have come up with this. What do you think the chances are Ron Paul runs as a Libertarian?
I don't actually think it's that big of a chance, and the reason being, he has a Republican challenger in his congressional seat down in Texas. And it's a serious challenge, a guy with some money and some standing. So I can't see, if he were to leave and run third party, he would be totally abandoning any chance he has of returning to Congress. So I think the chance is pretty slim.
Well, that's in his own primary, correct?
Correct.
And the elections in Texas, I'm trying to look for them, but typically they're very early. But I don't have the date for this year, but typically they're early, because my thinking is, if they were to have their, March primary elections, which I know in some years they've had them as early as March, he could vanquish that opponent and then still make the Libertarian run.
Yeah, that's possible. I just don't think it's that big of a chance. And I don't know that, I mean, he did attract, obviously has a large following among Libertarians, but there were Republicans who supported him as well. And so I think, I don't know that he would get very far in a third-party run.
Yes. Well, Tim Shiflett's also on the line with us. Tim, you have any questions for Buzz?
Yes, sir. First of all, I hope I am talking to a fellow Georgia Tech fan, am I?
Yes, sir, you are. Yep, I went to Georgia Tech, graduated in 1990.
Absolutely. Good to talk to you. And the question I have is, looking ahead to the general election in November, what are people in the conservative blogosphere saying about the election? Who would they rather face? Which Democratic candidate do you think would be tougher to face in November, and why?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton, you know, it's always dangerous to try to pick your opponent, but from where I stand, I think Hillary Clinton would be the better one to run against, just because she has a lot more baggage than Obama does, and it's easier to attack her. Obama doesn't carry all that baggage of having a controversial president as a spouse, and so I think it would be better to face Hillary. But I mean, that's part of the appeal of John McCain, is that he consistently has run head to head in the head to head polls, has done very well against both Obama and Clinton. I think the current Real Clear Politics average shows him ahead of Hillary by almost 2% and ahead of Obama by 3%. It was pretty close, but still slightly better against Obama. But just Hillary, I think, you know, she's one of the more divisive figures in all of American politics, has high negative polling numbers, and that's always tough to overcome for any candidate. But that would sort of be my view on it.
Yeah, and staying with that theme of the presidential election, if you are advising Senator McCain, could you give me a favorite name or two that you would like to see him put on his short list of vice presidential candidates?
Well, I think something that showed us that was demonstrated on Super Tuesday was that McCain is very strong. He ran well in Georgia, but he didn't win. And that was sort of true in a number of southern states, and she saw it again this past weekend in Louisiana. A southerner would come to mind, somebody like Jim DeMint from South Carolina, maybe Mark Sanford from South Carolina. Another good one might be Tom Coburn from Oklahoma. And these are kind of folks, what I'm thinking is that since McCain needs to bring conservatives along with him, he needs to pick somebody who's conservative. His weakest area on Super Tuesday was the South, so I would look for Southern conservatives if I were advising him.
Okay, thank you, sir. David?
Yes. Well, Buzz, still talking about the national numbers, but bringing it back to Georgia. No one could deny that the Republican Party is in control of Georgia right now. But then on Super Tuesday, Democrats got more votes for the president in the presidential elections, the primary, than Republicans did. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's very troubling, and the Republican Party should pay attention, not just in Georgia, all over the country. I think Democrats may have drawn, I can't remember the exact number, but it is millions of more votes nationwide in their primaries and caucuses than Republicans have, and that's very concerning. I think in Georgia, I think there are two factors. One, on the Republican side, there's not a candidate that has really inspired people. It's kind of like a collection of people, and well, we got to pick one. And so there hasn't really been that one person who's generated excitement. Whereas on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton obviously has a very huge following, and Barack Obama has just come out of the blue and generated enormous excitement. So I think that is what I'm saying explains it all. But it is troubling. Republicans need to pay attention to it, and And even though Georgia's been a red state, it could very easily change to a blue state if people aren't careful. And I think one thing that that Republicans need to pay attention to, let's say that it's Obama is the nominee for the Democratic Party. He may not win Georgia, but he could have coattails nonetheless and affect House races and Senate races, and even we have a couple very competitive congressional races here in Georgia, and where a swing of 3 or 4% could make all the difference. So it is something to really pay attention to and watch.
Yes, I know they always talk about in '84, Richard Shelby was elected as a Democrat because of Jesse Jackson. Registration numbers went up for him in the primary in '84. Well, I mean, if Obama was actually the candidate, you'd have to think those numbers in southern states would really jump.
Yeah.
I don't know how many different districts it could change as far as change what there is, but I think it could definitely take John Barrow and Jim Marshall's districts off the target list for the Republicans.
Yeah, well, I think you look at, if Obama is the nominee, African-American turnout will be sky high. Obama has shown an ability to attract young people, which, MTV has been trying to get young people to vote for 20 years and hasn't been able to do it. But here comes Obama, and he's doing it.
Yeah. Well, and I guess looking at the Senate race then, what do you make of the Senate race? Saxby-Chambliss, what's the feeling of most Republicans about Saxby-Chambliss? And then in turn, what are y'all's views of the field of candidates we have?
I think Saxby's in a pretty strong position. I think he feels pretty strong, which is probably why he stepped out and endorsed McCain, even though a lot of it caused some controversy for him. But I don't think it'll cause him any long-term damage endorsing McCain, especially now with McCain being the nominee of the party, essentially. On the Democratic side, I don't see anybody who can really challenge him. I think Saxby, barring some unforeseen disaster on Saxby's part, I just don't see a Democrat beating him.
Do you see one of those candidates as stronger than the others, or?
Well, I had thought Dale Cardwell actually was a pretty strong candidate, but I thought his climbing on top of the tower was kind of goofy. But I don't know if you can underestimate Vernon Jones. He's fun to throw stones at, but he's a fighter and a survivor. And so I would look for one of those two to emerge.
Yeah. Well, I guess them bringing it back deeply into the state. A lot of controversy this year under the Gold Dome, where it's Republicans against Republicans. What are your personal thoughts on what Speaker Richardson's been doing to his fellow Republicans by moving them out of office, stripping them of positions, and whatnot?
Well, I don't like it. I don't like it at all. I know that Tom Murphy over the years has done that sort of thing, and it's not without precedent, but this is not the kind of stuff that Republicans worked hard to elect people for. Republicans, I guess it's one of our faults, is we love to have our fights out in public, and this is another case of that, but we're having a fight out in public, and I just don't see what it's for. What's the purpose of it? If it was some important policy issue, then I could see having a knockdown, drag-out fight, but it's not. It's a power play. The speaker's throwing a temper tantrum, more or less, because he didn't get his way on the Department of Transportation board. So I think it looks silly, and it does not reflect well on Republican leadership. So yeah. I hope they stop.
Yes, and I guess getting back down to the Capitol, but still tying to national politics, every once in a while I hear Sonny Perdue's name come up on a VP list. As a Georgia Republican, what do you make of that?
Well, excuse me. I think he... I know some of my friends will laugh at me, but I think he would make a pretty good VP. Outside of Georgia, he's perceived fairly well. He's a soft-spoken guy with a very pleasing personality and public persona. I think that would not be all that bad a choice, actually. I don't know that he's with McCain's vice presidential pick, because of his age, I think that whoever he picks as his VP is sort of going to be viewed as the heir apparent and the person whom, McCain is almost anointing a successor. So I don't know that Sonny Perdue would make that list. I think he might go with one of these younger senators that are in the currently up there. So I don't know that Sonny would make the short list, but I don't think he'd be all that bad a choice, frankly.
Yeah, I will say this. As far as, like, personal skeletons, I don't think he'd have a lot, although I don't know that he would help contrast a young, dynamic figure like Barack Obama.
Right. I think you're right on that.
Yes. Well, Tim, you have any further questions for Buzz?
Well, I have one more. And, I'm a realist, if nothing else. And obviously, there's a better-than-average chance that the next governor of Georgia will also be a Republican. And we know that we've heard Glenn Richardson's name. We know that Casey Cagle has been mentioned. We know that Senator Isaacson's been mentioned. Who would you like for the next governor of Georgia to be, and why?
Well, I think Senator Isaacson would make a very good governor. I think Lieutenant Governor Cagle would as well. I would. I think if Johnny Isaacson runs, then no other big name Republican will challenge him. He's extremely popular, as you know, here in Georgia, especially
yes.
among Republicans and really among a lot of independents as well. So I think don't take this as an endorsement, but I think Senator Isaacson would make a great governor.
Okay, thank you, sir. David?
Yeah, well, Buzz, thank you for being on the show. I hope we weren't too hostile.
Oh, no.
but thank you for coming on and giving us the Republican perspective, because obviously we can interpret what we think, but it's just a different mindset and different view of things, so we have to get a real true source at times for comparison.
Well, great. I'm glad I could help, and I really enjoyed it, and I hope you'll have me on again.
Sure thing. Is as things move along, there'll be different issues that arise that we'll need this perspective again. But Buzz, thanks for coming on, and talk to you soon.
Thanks, David. Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it.
Good night, sir.
Sure.
Good night.
Yeah, well, that was good to have some thought there. I think a lot of it, we've thought and heard before that, the Republicans, just don't see any dynamic choices. I think their definition of dynamics a little different than ours as a party, but we've sensed that, and I think some other folks have told us that, and Buzz just reaffirmed it.
Yeah, yes, he did. I found it interesting, David, that he said what I figured he probably would about the next governor's race, that it really is Johnny Isaacson's nomination for the taking if he wants it, regardless of what Casey Cagle or Glenn Richardson do.
Yes, and I tell you one thing, a lot, particularly Johnny Isaacson, if he's the candidate, I think we can win that race, but we have to pick somebody young, new, and vibrant.
Absolutely, and with money.
It just can't be a 55, 60-year-old guy that, looks like he's older. I think we need to go a lot younger and make a good contrast. Well, I think our next guest, Representative Talay, is out with us. Representative?
Yeah. How are you?
Oh, doing good. Thanks for calling in.
Good. Oh, thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Sure. Well, things have been going on at the Capitol now for a few weeks and need to get an update. I know this week the Democratic Party has released their own tax plan, which wouldn't hurt education funding. Kind of give us the details of that plan.
Yeah, well, it's sort of a two-step plan. The first phase is for this year and next year, and it calls for $300 million each year to be put in from the surplus. Surplus is now over $1.6 billion. The $300 million we put in a fund, and then county school boards can get that money if they agree to roll back property taxes dollar for dollar for what they get. And the thinking behind this is as follows. About two-thirds of Georgia counties have increased property taxes as a direct result of cuts in education funding from the state. state used to pay about 60 cents of every dollar spent educating kids in K through 12. Now we're down under 50% and moving towards the mid-40s. Governor, for reasons unbeknownst really to anybody in either party, has suggested continuing that. And that's one of the reasons property taxes are getting out of hand in Georgia. And so this plan will allow us to do two things at one. First, restore that education funding, and second, roll back property taxes at the local level, which is something everybody, I think, wants and needs. The second piece is more permanent, and it's a really simple bill which says that the Georgia General Assembly shall fund the QBE formula for education. We've got this formula that we put in place that tells us how much to spend per child. And again, over the last 5 to 6 years, we've cut that by about $1.5 billion. If we would just go ahead and commit to fully fund education, and what could be more important? You'll see improvements in education and relief in local property taxes. So it's a two-part plan, and it allows you to fully fund education and give people property tax relief. That's a pretty good 1-2 punch.
Yeah. I know the Democrats in the House and Senate are coalescing a lot around a lot of issues, not just this one, and we're being a pretty cohesive team, but, of course, we got to get some Republicans on board to get anything to pass. What's the reception been of some of the your Republican colleagues to this measure?
They don't really know what to do yet because on the House side, you've got Glenn's tax plan, the Speaker's tax plan, which is still sort of hanging out there almost like a dark cloud over the session. And so a lot of Republicans are kind of waiting to see what further incarnations there'll be of that before they commit to do anything else on taxes. Of course, now Cagle and Eric Johnson over on the Senate side are starting to put out some ideas on property taxes, and so they're pretty much staying in place too. So we've not seen much support yet on taxes, but there is some good news about our Republican friends on the House side so far this session, which is that they're exerting a little bit of independence, the rank-and-file members, which is something that we had not seen since Republicans took over the House starting in 2005, on two issues that are not necessarily issues that win or lose elections and that the public would have followed. A lot of Republicans broke from their leadership and voted with Democrats to do good things for Georgia. First vote was on credit freeze legislation. There were some very consumer-friendly amendments that I and a couple of others offered, and we won that vote with more than 95 people in the House. And the second was some votes on amendments to a medical bill to help nurses, again, pretty much a Democratic amendment. One in the House. We've not seen that before. By and large, they've stayed lockstep. When the Speaker wants a vote to go a certain way, when Jerry Keane wants it to go a certain way, there's been very little movement. This year, we're seeing something happen in that caucus, and it's very interesting. It makes me optimistic about our ability to do some things this year.
Yes, and I guess long term, what do you think is it going to take for us to really break away in elections and win some of these seats back, win the governor's seat eventually? What are the Republicans going to do to give us that opening?
They're doing a lot. They're doing a lot as we speak. The internal bickering is really sort of a sideshow. I don't think the public cares much about it by and large, but it is starting to become an impediment to getting anything done. Nothing's happened on taxes. We're about to have a big fight over education again because finally the House leadership has agreed with Democrats to restore some of these education funds that Perdue is cutting, and I don't suspect Perdue will relent from his position easily. And so, their division both within their caucuses and between the governor's office and the legislative leadership is helpful to us. I mean, I think it allows Democrats to make the kind of case that we've seen be so effective nationally of change and of the fact that the system in Atlanta is broken and it's not working for regular Georgians, and it won't until you change out who's in control, and then we can get some things done. So I think it's coming together pretty nicely at this point.
Yes. Well, also with us is Tim Shiflett. I'm going to give Tim a chance to ask some questions. Tim, you have any questions?
Sure.
Yes, sir, I do, and it's kind of going along in the vein of what you're talking about now, and that is the GOP in the House.
Mm.
Is there a chance that when the GOP caucus convenes again to elect leadership that they might actually remove Glenn Richardson as Speaker?
It is my perception from afar, and I'm not in their caucus meetings, don't want to be in their meetings. But near as I can tell, you've now got about three different caucuses inside the House Republicans, and I think that is more likely than it has ever been. Like I've said before, we're seeing people break from their leadership and from their committee chairs on some pretty important things, not only those procedural votes I talked about earlier, but on the DOT, which got a lot of attention, and the retribution is getting a lot of attention. And so I think that the Speaker is in a dangerous place. And, of course, nobody really can remember the last time a sitting Speaker was deposed from within his own party. But I think that he's in a dangerous place. You know, the DOT thing did not go well. And the punishment that he meted out to his members has not been well received. The property tax plan, which he's worked so hard for a year to try to build support for, doesn't have the votes, in my opinion. And so he's looking at a string of pretty high-profile defeats where he's put his members in a bad place. And I remember when Terry Coleman was Speaker, somebody was telling me once that one of the jobs of a Speaker of the House that doesn't get much attention is to protect the members. You don't put things out there for votes that are controversial where there aren't the votes to pass it or where it's not super important. And I think he's putting his people out in some pretty hot issues and is not prevailing on them. And, you know, at a certain point, membership rebels against that sort of thing. For a Democrat in the House, it's kind of fun to watch. but I don't know how it'll turn out. I don't know that anybody can know. But we're ready to work with whoever is willing to be helpful to us in doing some things that are good for Georgians.
Okay, thank you, sir. David?
Yeah. What was some of the reaction when he made those moves that were so controversial this past week?
Yeah, I think within the caucus it was received pretty tough, and the DOT, the Department of Transportation board elections, were a complicated issue. It became portrayed publicly, and I think that it actually was on the Speaker's part a case of attempting to punish someone for not putting in the DOT commissioner that he wanted, and so trying to remove those board members sort of as a political retribution. I think that was accurate. I think that's what it was. But there's a case to be made that the Department of Transportation is pretty terribly run and has been for a while. And so maybe some of those board members should have been replaced. The Speaker wasn't able to make that case publicly very well at all, and so his guys broke from him and were punished. And it seems to have really created a stir inside that caucus. And, it's interesting because one of the members that lost his positions because he didn't vote the way the Speaker wanted was a hawk. And I don't know how much y'all have sort of followed the evolution of the hawks, but when the Republicans took over, they put in place these positions called hawks. And all a hawk does is float around the building rigging votes in committee. You know, say you're on the Judiciary Committee that has a certain number of members, and it appears that Democrats are about to win a vote in committee. The Speaker can send in a hawk to sit on the committee having not heard any of the testimony, not a member of the committee, and he can vote. And so I thought there was some irony in the fact that one of the guys that got stripped of his job for not voting the way the Speaker wanted is a guy whose job was to walk around the building making sure people voted the way the Speaker wanted. So it certainly seems to have turned some heads and got a lot of attention around the state. I mean, I've had people in my district who don't necessarily follow DOT board elections or anything like that who have asked about what on earth is going on down there. So
it's resonating.
I mean, the friction is gaining some attention.
Yes, I think the legislature, it seems to get less and less coverage, but that was one thing that did get a little attention in the newspapers and in the media was those moves. Well, talking about issues and talking about transportation, that's obviously, I would think, year in and year out, one of the bigger issues in Georgia, certainly north half of Georgia. It looks like little's getting done. Are there things we're not seeing that are getting done?
No, you know, nothing has happened really. Well, that may not be fair. Nothing significant has happened, I think you could say, arguably, since Governor Barnes created the Georgia Regional Transportation Authority, or GRETA, which was supposed to really become a comprehensive planning and development agency to sort of make sure that transportation and congestion were thought of and dealt with in making decisions about the metro area. You know, there have been some small things, you know, through bond packages and things like that. But, you know, in terms of, particularly in the metropolitan Atlanta area, congestion mitigation, just making traffic easier to deal with, or getting a transit system that keeps pace with the growth in population that we anticipate having, nothing's happened. And I think it's one of the most scathing indictments of Republican leadership over the last 5-6 years that we can make, because everyone sees the problem and everyone sits in it. And even people from Republican counties, you know, are demanding some action on this, and just nothing has happened. There's not been much political courage shown. That, you know, the hard part about transportation is there's no easy way to do it. All of the decisions that you might make are controversial. And we've seen from this group of leaders an unwillingness to sort of make the tough calls and take the criticism that'll come along with it.
Yes, and that's the issue that's been going on a while, and of course an issue that's a new issue on the table just this past year that came to a head was water. What's going on with finding solutions for water other than giving $100 for putting in new toilets?
Yeah. Yeah, similar thing to transportation. You know, we've sort of started already to back away from some of the harder things that it's a great time to do. So we've done some of the easy stuff, right? We did the statewide water management plan, which wasn't a response to the drought, but has sort of been portrayed that way. And that plan is important. I don't mean to minimize it. You know, it puts in place a planning system to, first of all, do the science on where the water is and how much there is and who's using how much, so that you can then plan its use with some good scientific basis rather than just sort of the off the top of the head way we've done it. And so that was done right at the beginning of the session. Important. There's been funding put in the budget for reservoir expansion and development. Reservoirs are fine, and it's a part of the answer. But reservoirs cost, usually to build a new one, well in excess of $100 million. It takes about 10 years to get one online from development forward. And so it's not really going to help us much in the short term. And there are a lot of reasons that you can't just reservoir your way out of this problem. There's not been anything done on the conservation or efficiency side. And I think people are ready for that. You know, one of the advantages of a crisis like we've had with water, and which may not be over. I mean, last I talked to somebody, we still anticipate a dry summer, so we're not out of the woods on this thing. But I think people are ready to be asked to do something and to be asked to be more efficient and to conserve. And you mentioned one thing, which was to sort of incentivize people to use better water efficient utilities in their home, things like toilets and shower heads, through a tax credit, and that's fine. Incentives are fine. I think that's a decent starting point. But on new construction, we can and should require those things, and it's not too much to ask. If you're seeking permits to build a new thing, a new home now or a new commercial development, it's really not too much to ask to go ahead and do this, because it's not as if water is not going to continue to be an ongoing issue in the foreseeable future. I mean, if we really do double our population in the metro area over the next 18, 20 years, you know, water, no matter how many reservoirs we build, we're going to have to be efficient with it. And it's a manageable problem, but this would be a perfect time to do some of those tougher things, like require the low-flow toilets and showerheads in at least new construction. And unfortunately, I'm not seeing a lot of political courage on the part of the Republicans to do that stuff. And if you can't do it this year, the question really is begged of when can you do it?
Yeah, so you just hope it gets better. Oh, hope we have rain this year and it's not a problem.
And the problem is that the market might eventually fix it for us. I mean, if we can't maintain decent infrastructure, if people are going to sit in their car for 45 minutes to try to get to work, and if there's not going to be adequate water, people are going to stop locating their jobs here eventually. I mean, it's hard for people who've lived in this area a long time to imagine, given the explosive growth that we've had. But, you know, this golden goose does not necessarily have to live forever, and we've seen other major job centers that have not done those things right and have really suffered. And so, you know, the failure to do these things, while it may sort of pay in some short-term political dividend by not making people mad at you, has a real long-term consequence. And so we ought to all get together and agree to sort of take the hit together, if there's one to be taken, and get some things done on transportation and water and some of those sort of nuts and bolts issues that aren't real sexy, but that just have to be done.
Yes. Well, Representative Fillet, I was going to say you're in Cobb County, and I guess the Republican move kind of started happening way back when in the, I guess, the 80s, maybe even the late 70s in a place like Cobb. Cobb was one of the first places that started Go Republican. It looks like now Cobb and Gwinnett and a few of the counties will be the places where it goes back Democratic first. What districts around you, state Senate or state House, look like they're good targets for us this year, and what's going on there?
I think what you've just said is exactly true, and I've told our leadership and the folks at the state party that, you know, I really believe that when Georgia Democrats regain majorities in the House and Senate again, it's going to be when we really start to dominate some of these suburban areas. Cobb and Gwinnett are perfect examples. This is the phenomenon we've seen in Virginia over the last few years. I mean, it wasn't 10 years ago that Virginia was thought to be a hopelessly red state. And now they have a Democratic governor, one Democratic U.S. senator, and soon to be another Democratic U.S. senator. And, of course, their House and Senate are very close. I think one is in Democratic control, maybe both. So what you just said is exactly right. And I really think that Georgia is eventually going to settle into a situation like Virginia, like North Carolina, where it's a very competitive two-party system. And Cobb's going to be a place where that starts. There's a seat in Smyrna, District 34, and in Marietta, the number's escaping me, I think it may be 38, Steve Tumlin is the Republican representative up there, that by numbers are very good targets. The hard thing from a partisan standpoint is that those guys are really good reps, and they're very good campaigners. And, you know, it's going to be an uphill battle, but I think those are seats where there is an opportunity. And I'm not so familiar with Gwinnett, but I imagine there's got to be similar demographics. And the key for us is to try to pick up as many seats as we can in the 2008 and 10 election, because reapportionment's coming soon.
Yeah.
And we don't want reapportionment with solid Republican majorities in both the House and Senate. That would be a very bad thing for Democrats.
Yes, and that's why, where the governor's race comes in play, although that's, you know, after the presidential, after this year's Senate race, I guess we can really gear up on that. But obviously it's something somebody needs to be thinking about ahead of time.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, one of the things that will help us in elections at the House and Senate level is to have some good top-of-the-ballot races, you know, good competitive campaigns where we're doing well at the top, because, you know, for average voters, it's a lot to ask for them to really follow state house elections or school board or county commission elections as closely as they do those elections at the top of the ballot, because people are busy. They got lives to lead, and a lot of them are scratching at a living and trying to raise their kids, and they're not necessarily following a state house race blow for blow. But they know if the Democrats don't have a good U.S. Senate candidate, you know, they'll see whoever that person is a lot, and they'll know what's going on in that race. And it does affect their voting pattern down ballot. And so, you know, in both 2008 and 2010, very important that we're competitive at the top of the ballot.
Yes, well, I probably wouldn't ask you about this, but you kind of, you know, leaned towards it or jumped in it, whatever
boy.
You say. What are your thoughts on the U.S. Senate race thus far?
Well, you know, I think it's, for Democrats, I think it's sitting there as an opportunity. Chambliss has not served the people of Georgia well. His numbers are not particularly strong, and he is a great target. It's clear, and I don't think I'll get in too much trouble for saying this, but maybe I will. It's clear that none of the Democrats in the race at the moment have sort of taken that nomination and that race by the horns and made it theirs. And so it sort of continues to be an open question in my mind as to whether we're going to be as competitive as we need to be. And maybe one of those candidates can assert themselves that way. Or maybe there's another person out there. But, you know, that's something I worry about. And I'm thinking about it. I mean, I was a John Edwards supporter until he dropped out, partly because of this concern. I felt like he would be a very strong general election candidate in Georgia and would, if he didn't win Georgia, would at least be competitive and keep the race close and would make an effort in the state, which would be helpful to a lot of people. And so from the presidential race to the U.S. Senate race, it's, you know, I really want to see us compete in Georgia. It makes it so hard when our presidential candidates write us off at the beginning and adopt this bizarre strategy of trying to win 19 states to get the presidency. I mean, I realize the electoral math suggests that that's possible, but we've tried that twice in a row, and, you know, just put you in a very tough spot because you had to sort of run the table. There's no margin for error. You have to win either Ohio or Florida, which are generally Republican states. It'd be nice to have a larger market area for error and a different map.
Yes, I guess there's two competing theories. There's the Foxes in the Hen House book with those fellas, which actually I believe backed Edwards and were in his campaign, saying mm-hmm. expand the map, and this is how you appeal to culturally to Southerners. And then, of course, then you had whistling past Dixie saying, hey, pick these states, and you can write off all 13 states, maybe play a little bit in Florida, but you can pretty much, you know, forget all the rest of those people. And obviously that's one plan, maybe win nationally, but it would not do anything for us in the South.
Yeah, and there's no future in that nationally either, I don't think. And for whatever other criticisms some people may have of him, and no matter what you thought of his presidential race, Howard Dean is doing something that I do think is very important by saying, we are going to compete everywhere. And there are going to be times where that looks like a bad investment because you're building an infrastructure and you're just starting to engage people. But I think we're seeing signs of real progress in areas not only of the country but within the demographics that maybe you wouldn't have expected a couple of years ago. Evangelicals is a perfect example. Democrats have finally said, you know, there is more to life than just the two issues that this community has always been talked to by politicians about forever that our faith can instruct us on, and Democrats can compete among evangelical Christians with a politics that matches faith. The New Testament is full of references on how you deal with people who are in poverty, with the treatment of children, and the elderly, and these are things that are right in the Democratic wheelhouse, and our candidates are finally competing for those votes again. I think that's so important, not only from a political standpoint, but just from a general well-being of society standpoint. It's just not good when whole groups of society are not talked to by a political party and not pursued and not asked for their vote. Just not good. And so I think we've seen progress in those areas, and we're seeing progress in parts of the country that you wouldn't have thought it was possible.
Absolutely. Well, Representative Talay, I'm going to leave you with this. Going down to JJ dinner, talking with some folks, and somebody asked me who I thought some senators, reps, and whatnot, and Democratic Party had a real upside, and you were one of the two people I mentioned, and
that's
one of the reasons I invited you on the show, and you did not disappoint. I definitely think you have a real upside in the party, and I just want you to keep doing good work so you can continue to grow that base, if you will.
Well, I'm going to get you in trouble. You almost got me in trouble and may have some. Who was the other person?
One of our state representatives from DeKalb County. I thought Representative Stuckey's another one that our Benefield that has some real upside.
Sure.
I think a lot of times having older leaders can be good, but I think as you were coming on the show, I mentioned, I think in some of these races we really need to get a little younger. Even though I voted and support Hillary Clinton, I think I see what Barack Obama's doing, being younger, a fresher face, a lot of energy. And I think if they put up somebody like Johnny Isaacson, we got to go with somebody a little younger with, you know, maybe a younger family to put a good contrast against that.
Yeah, I think we've got a real opportunity the next cycle or two. I mean, everything is pointing in 2008 to a big year for Democrats that should help our people. So I thank you guys for everything you do. I always have blog time every morning and make sure to read everybody's thoughts on everything. And it's awfully important what you're doing.
Sure, yeah, and download it. It's always a podcast there on Monday mornings and throughout the week.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for being on.
Y'all have a good evening.
Okay. Well, Tim, we've left you just a little bit of time for the outrage of the week, so go at it, and then we'll close it down from there.
Okay, David, I want to talk about when I read the newspaper. When I do lately, even I sound like a broken record. It seems that I say the same thing at the same time every single day. Right then, every day, I find myself saying, again, this guy is just losing it. I like to give most everyone the benefit of the doubt, because anyone can have an off day. Anyone can make an occasional mistake. Even the best people in government can stumble. But Glenn Richardson just takes it to another level. We have all read and heard about the recent battle for the 9th district seat on the DOT board. Speaker Richardson had recruited a candidate to challenge board member Mike Evans, who is a favorite of both Governor Sonny Perdue and Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle. Now the speaker apparently intends to severely punish four House members who voted for Evans, who won re-election to the board. Representative Doug Collins of Gainesville and Representative Martin Scott of Rossville have both been stripped of chairmanships of House subcommittees. And if that wasn't enough, the speaker showed his vindictive side even further by setting about to personally fine GOP primary opponents for the two other representatives, John Meadows and Tom Graves. Both of these men hail from Gordon County. To make matters even more embarrassing for Richardson, the Calhoun Times up our way has led a chorus of small-town newspapers in North Georgia who have written scathing editorials against his actions. This is simply more evidence that this speaker doesn't know what he's doing. From his dead-on-arrival legislative proposals to his dealings with other state leaders, he just always seems to project incompetence. And now we see that he doesn't even know how to deal with members in the legislative body that he professes to lead. Is it any wonder, then, that little or nothing of substance seems to come from the Republicans who control the state House? Is it any wonder that problems are going unsolved and piling up? Now I realize that the GOP members of the Georgia House of Representatives owe me no favors, but I feel it vitally important to make a request anyway. For the good of Georgia, I ask this one thing. The next time you folks caucus to choose your leadership, how about making a change at the top? What has Glenn Richardson done for you? What has he done for Georgia? God, I miss Tom Murphy, David.
Yes. I think if we had to pick one topic since we started this show of your outrages of the week, Glenn Richardson would have the plurality, and it's not that you're picking on him. He just keeps
He keeps bringing himself to the forefront of stupidity, to just be brutally honest about it.
Yes. When we talk about running for governor, winning that, can you imagine if we elected Speaker of the House at the statewide level? I think we'd have a real good shot at taking that thing back.
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, Tim, another solid show. I really enjoyed our guest. I still can't get over someone in the comments on Peach Pundits talking about us being a hostile environment. But hopefully I don't think anybody thought we were too hostile to our Republican friend, Buzz Brockway.
And also, I think he did a fabulous job, by the way, Dave.
He did. It's good to hear from the other side and get some thoughts. Because this, what we're talking about there, that's more process. It's not about how we feel about certain issues. So shouldn't be contentious. And
absolutely.
then Senator Tlai, Representative Tlai, did an excellent job. And I know you see him more and more being one of the spokespeople in the face there of the Democratic Party in the State House, and you can see why after our short interview with him tonight.
Yes, sir.
Yes, well, look forward to next week's show, and we'll have a little more information. I guess there'll be the Potomac primaries between now and then, and maybe there'll be a little sense coming out of Speaker Richardson's office, and maybe he'll calm down, but never know.
Sounds good. Good night.
See you then.